Chapter 11. To use that box anymore. The vividness of the thought, checked a man for an infinitesimal fraction of a second. His fingers closed again on the small object, as though it had been the symbol of all these little habits that chain us to the weary round of life. He released it at last, and letting himself fall on the settee, listened for the first sounds of returning wind. Not yet. He heard only the wash of water, the heavy splashes, the dull shocks of the confused seas boarding his ship from all sides. She would never have a chance to clear her decks. But the quietude of the air was startlingly tense and unsafe, like a slender hair holding a sword suspended over his head. By this awful pause the storm penetrated the defenses of the man, and unsealed his lips. He spoke out in the solitude, and the pitch darkness of the cabin, as if addressing another being awakened within his breast. "I shouldn't like to lose her," he said half aloud. He sat unseen, apart from the sea, from his ship, isolated, as if withdrawn from the very current of his own existence, where such freaks as talking to himself surely had no place. His palms reposed on his knees, he bowed his short neck and puffed heavily, surrendering to a strange sensation of weariness he was not enlightened enough to recognize for the fatigue of mental stress. From where he sat he could reach the door of a washstand locker. There should have been a towel there. There was. Good. He took it out, wiped his face, and afterwards went on rubbing his wet head. He toweled himself with energy in the dark, and then remained motionless with the towel on his knees. A moment passed, of a stillness so profound that no one could have guessed there was a man sitting in that cabin. Then a murmur arose. She may come out of it yet. When Captain McWhirr came out on deck, which he did brusquely, as though he had suddenly become conscious of having stayed away too long, the calm had lasted already more than 15 minutes long enough to make itself intolerable even to his imagination. Jukes, motionless on the forepart of the bridge, began to speak at once. His voice, blank and forced, as though he were talking through hard-set teeth, seemed to flow away on all sides into the darkness, deepening again upon the sea. I had the wheel relieved. Hackett began to sing out that he was done. He's lying in there alongside the steering gear with a face like death. At first I couldn't get anybody to crawl out and relieve the poor devil. That bosun's worse than no good, I always said. Thought I would have had to go myself, and haul out one of them by the neck. Ah, well, muttered the captain. He stood watchful by Juke's side. The second mate's in there too, holding his head. Is he hurt, sir? No crazy, said Captain McWhirr, curtly. Looks as if he had a tumble, though. I had to give him a push, explained the captain. Jukes gave an impatient sigh. It will come very sudden, said Captain McWhirr, and from over there, I fancy. God only knows, though. These books are only good to muddle your head and make you jumpy. It will be bad, and there's an end. If we only can steam around in time to meet it. A minute passed. Some of the stars winked rapidly and vanished. You left them pretty safe? Began the captain abruptly, as though the silence were unbearable. Are you thinking of the coolies, sir? I rigged lifelines all ways across that tween deck. Did you? Good idea, Mr. Jukes. I didn't. Think you cared to No, said Jukes. The lurching of the ship cut his speech, as though somebody had been jerking him around while he talked. How I got on with. That infernal job. We did it. And it may not matter in the end. Had to do what's fair, for all they are only Chinamen. Give them the same chance with ourselves, hang it all. She isn't lost yet. Bad enough to be shut up below in a gale, that's what I thought when you gave me the job, sir, interjected Jukes, moodily. Without being battered to pieces, pursued Captain McWhirr with rising vehemence. Old let that go on in my ship, if I knew as he hadn't 5 minutes to live. Couldn't bear it, Mr. Jukes. A hollow echoing noise, like that of a shout rolling in a rocky chasm, approached the ship, and went away again. The last star, blurred, enlarged, as if returning to the fiery mist of its beginning, struggled with the colossal depth of blackness hanging over the ship and went out. "Now for it," muttered Captain McWhirr. "Mr. Jukes." "Here, sir." The two men were growing indistinct to each other. "We must trust her to go through it, and come out on the other side. That's plain and straight. There's no room for Captain Wilson's storm strategy here." "No, sir. She will be smothered and swept again for hours," mumbled the captain. "Here's not much left by this time above deck for the sea to take away, unless you or me." "Both, sir," whispered Jukes, breathlessly. "You are always meeting trouble halfway, Jukes," Captain McWhirr remonstrated quaintly. "Hawk, it's a fact that the second mate is no good. Do you hear, Mr. Jukes? You would be left alone if..." Captain McWhirr interrupted himself, and Jukes, glancing on all sides, remained silent. "Don't you be put out by anything," the captain continued, mumbling rather fast. "Keep her facing it. They may say what they like, but the heaviest seas run with the wind. Facing it, always facing it, that's the way to get through. You are a young sailor. Face it. That's enough for any man. Keep a cool head." "Yes, sir," said Jukes, with a flutter of the heart. In the next few seconds the captain spoke to the engine room, and got an answer. For some reason Jukes experienced an access of confidence, a sensation that came from outside like a warm breath, and made him feel equal to every demand. The distant muttering of the darkness stole into his ears. He noted it unmoved, out of that sudden belief in himself, as a man safe in a shirt of mail would watch a point. The ship labored without intermission amongst the black hills of water, paying with this hard tumbling the price of her life. She rumbled in her depths, shaking a white plummet of steam into the night, and Jukes' thought skimmed like a bird through the engine room, where Mr. Outgoodman was ready. When the rumbling ceased, it seemed to him that there was a pause of every sound, a dead pause in which Captain McWhirr's voice rang out startlingly. "What's that? A puff of wind?" It spoke much louder than Jukes had ever heard it before, and the bow. "That's right. She may come out of it yet." The mutter of the wind drew near apace. In the forefront, could be distinguished a drowsy waking plaint passing on, and far off the growth of a multiple clamor, marching and expanding. There was the throb, as of many drums in it, a vicious rushing note, and like the chant of a tramping multitude. Jukes could no longer see his captain distinctly. The darkness was absolutely piling itself upon the ship. At most he made out movements, a hint of elbows spread out, of a head thrown up. Captain McWhirr was trying to do up the top button of his oilskin coat with unwonted haste. The hurricane, with its power to madden the seas, to sink ships, to uproot trees, to overturn strong walls and dash the very birds of the air to the ground, had found this taciturn man in its path, and, doing its utmost, had managed to wring out a few words. Before the renewed wrath of wind swooped on his ship, Captain McWhirr was moved to declare, in a tone of vexation, "As it were, colon, I wouldn't like to lose her." He was spared that annoyance. Why, on a bright sunshiny day, with the breeze chasing her smoke far ahead, the Nan Shan came into Fuchao. Her arrival was at once noticed on shore, and the seaman in harbor said, "Colon, look. Look at that steamer. What's that? Siamese, isn't she? Just look at her." She seemed, indeed, to have been used as a running target for the secondary batteries of a cruiser. A hail of minor shells could not have given her upper works a more broken, torn, and devastated aspect. And as he had about her the worn, weary air of ships coming from the far ends of the world, and indeed with truth, for in her short passage he had been very far, sighting, verily, even the coast of the great beyond, whence no ship ever returns to give up her crew to the dust of the earth. She was incrusted, and gray with salt to the trucks of her masts, and to the top of her funnel, As though, as some facetious seaman said, the crowd on board had fished her out somewhere from the bottom of the sea and brought her in here for salvage. And further, excited by the felicity of his own wit, he offered to give £5 for her as she stands. Before as he had been quite an hour at rest, a meager little man, with a red-tipped nose and a face cast in an angry mold, landed from a sampan on the quay of the foreign concession, and incontinently turned to shake his fist at her. A tall individual, with legs much too thin for a rotund stomach, and with watery eyes, strolled up and remarked, "Just left her, eh? Quick work." He wore a soiled suit of blue flannel with a pair of dirty cricketing shoes. A dingy gray mustache drooped from his lip, and daylight could be seen in two places between the rim and the crown of his hat. "Hello. What are you doing here?" asked the executant mate of the Nan Shan, shaking hands hurriedly. "Standing by for a job chance worth taking, got a quiet hint," explained the man with the broken hat, in jerky, apathetic wheezes. The second shook his fist again at the Nan Shan. "Tee, there's a fellow there that ain't fit to have the command of a SCO," he declared, quivering with passion, while the other looked about listlessly. "Is there?" But he caught sight on the quay of a heavy seaman's chest, painted brown under a fringed sailcloth cover, and lashed with new manila line. He eyed it with awakened interest. "I would talk, and raise trouble, if it wasn't for that damn Siamese flag. Nobody to go to, or I would make it hot for him. The fraud. Told his chief engineer that's another fraud for you, I had lost my nerve. The greatest lot of ignorant fools that ever sailed the seas. No. You can't think. Dot, got your money all right?" inquired his seedy acquaintance suddenly. "Yes. Paid me off on board," raged the second mate. "Get your breakfast on shore," apostrophe says he. "Mean skunk," commented the tall man, vaguely, and passed his tongue on his lips. "Had about having a drink of some sort?" "He struck me," hissed the second mate. "No. Struck. You don't say?" The man in blue began to bustle about sympathetically. "And possibly talk here. I want to know all about it. Struck, eh? Let's get a fellow to carry your chest. I know a quiet place where they have some bottled beer." Mr. Jukes, who had been scanning the shore through a pair of glasses, informed the chief engineer afterwards that her late second mate hasn't been long in finding a friend. "A chap looking uncommonly like a bummer. I saw them walk away together from the quay." The hammering and banging of the needful repairs did not disturb Captain McWhirr. The steward found in the letter he wrote, in the tidy chart room, passages of such absorbing interest that twice he was nearly caught in the act. But Mrs. McWhirr, in the drawing room of the 40-pound house, stifled a yawn perhaps out of self-respect, for she was alone. She reclined in a plush-bottomed and gilt hammock chair near a tiled fireplace, with Japanese fans on the mantel and a glow of coals in the grate. Lifting her hands, she glanced wearily here and there into the many pages. It was not her fault they were so prosy, so completely uninteresting, from "Why, darling wife" at the beginning to "Our loving husband" at the end. She couldn't be really expected to understand all these ship affairs. She was glad, of course, to hear from him, but as he had never asked herself why, precisely. They are called typhoons. The mate did not seem to like it. Not in books. Couldn't think of letting it go on. The paper rustled sharply. A calm that lasted more than 20 minutes, she read perfunctorily, and the next words her thoughtless eyes caught, on the top of another page, were, "See you and the children again." As he had a movement of impatience. He was always thinking of coming home. He had never had such a good salary before. What was the matter now? Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.